This music from Kim Hill and Selah, All My Tears Be Washed Away. It is about 9 minutes after the hour. It's a Monday, and Don Clark joins us. Dr. Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and joins us from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, good morning. Happy Monday to you.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
And happy Monday to you, folks.
Yeah, David is testing out some new equipment this morning. I think so far it hasn't been a problem, has it, David?
So far, so good.
So far, so good. Okay.
It shows my flaws even better.
Well, this is audio equipment, and all David's flaws are vocal flaws. So yeah,
I'm running out of reasons to make excuses.
Yeah, Don, there was an article that came to our attention. Oh, must have been a week ago, and it's interesting on a number of accounts. It's in the Huffington Post. Apparently, they have a green news section of the Huffington Post where they talk about climactic things and, you know, I mean, climate changes, things that they kind of advocate and stand behind. This particular article is about Pacific Ocean warming. The headline is Pacific Ocean Warming at Fastest Rate in 10,000 Years. But the article goes on to express some dissatisfaction with the findings and with the original article that prompted this, which was published in the journal Science just recently. Ocean temperature, is there for sure a link between ocean temperatures and what falls on us?
Oh, well, the answer to that one is yes, because obviously if the water is warmer, if the ocean is warmer, then that's going to generate more humidity or more moisture in the air, which ultimately will be carried over to the continents and come out as either rain or snow, or depending on, you know, the temperature. So the warmer the oceans, you would think, well, the more moisture we're going to see on the land.
So it affects weather patterns, whether it's La Nina or El Nino. I think one is warming and one is cooling. I'm woefully ignorant on that count. But they've been tracking that for years now. And then comes this finding, which compares recent trends to trends over the past 10,000 years. How in the world do they know what happened 10,000 years ago with ocean temperatures?
Well, that is a very good question.
It's an ancient thermometer.
Yeah.
It's an ancient 10,000-year-old thermometer found yesterday morning.
And this is the kind of the interesting thing about this article, because it's extremely frustrating from a scientific point of view, because they make this the authors of the paper, not necessarily the authors of the article that's in the Huffington Post, but the authors of the paper make this claim that the rate of warming in the Pacific Ocean is the greatest that it's been in 10,000 years. Well, how do you even get a handle on the temperature in the past if you didn't have a thermometer and it hadn't been recorded down? And so obviously we don't have recorded temperatures, and we certainly don't have recorded temperatures of the ocean for that period of time.
Well, there must be a way of measuring some side effect of temperature to detect when it has changed, I imagine.
And this is where they take core samples of the ocean floor, and they look at stuff in the core samples and say, well, you know, did we have more plankton or organic matter or this or that and the other, and draw their conclusions from that. Now, the frustrating thing about this article is that they said, well, you know, core samples are great, but we really can't trust the top layers of the core sample. And you say, the natural question is, well, why is that? And they say, well, because sedimentation rate is really slow, and you've got all kinds of mixing going on. And so it's been found that the top layers of your core sample are not a reliable indicator of what's going on in the ocean, you know, today. Mm-hmm. So then you ask the question, well, if the top layers are not reliable, why in the world would you rely on any layer in a core sample?
It's like, how deep do you have to go before it becomes reliable?
Exactly. Yeah. And how long a period do you have to go before you can say, well, okay, that's a general trend. you know, the temperature was warm for, you know, 100 years, 1,000 years or whatever. And so we are finally seeing some evidence in the core samples. And, you know, I'm not an expert in this field to know how they calibrate that. If you can't calibrate the most recent temperatures, I don't see how you're going to calibrate anything within a core sample. And so, in my opinion, you know, the core samples aren't a good indication as to what went on in the past.
Well, and again, I'm totally over my head in this, so to speak. But if you go down to the bottom of the ocean and take a core sample, does 3 feet equal 1,000 years or 10 feet? Or how would you know? It seems to me that there's sediment. Is it a constant rate? I mean, how could they premise their findings on a core sample, other than seeing what was there and saying, well, at that time, whenever it was, that's what happened?
Right. That's another good question because, this is the whole problem in geology or these type of studies. In that you're assuming whatever the sedimentation rate is today is the same rate it was, you know, back how many, you know, thousands of years. And that assumption may or may not be accurate. For example, we have strong evidence. And this is just sediment that's around the world, and I would assume it would be on the ocean floor as well, is that, you know, we get most of our sediment or most of our deposits on the Earth through the global flood. And the global flood produced, you know, miles of sediments. So in that, you know, sediment is striated, obviously, and certain geologists say, well, that's, you know, evidence of millions of years. And because of the sedimentation rate, again, is slow, and so therefore we've got all these layers. But no, Mount St. Helens certainly demonstrated that you can have striations in your mud sediments, for example, which then turn into rock over a period of time. Mm-hmm. And it formed within minutes. So we have the same, you know, you could have the same type of thing in the ocean floor, because when sediment was being deposited around the world as mud and as the waters were crashing into bare rock, for example, during the flood, causing cavitation and causing the sediments, a lot of that sediment's going to be deposited on the ocean floor as well. Mm-hmm. So I can't see how you could say really anything about core samples either taken on Earth, you know, on dry land versus core samples taken in the middle of the ocean. You know, these folks kind of ignore our history books, and of course I'm talking about Genesis in particular, say, well, okay, all of this is due to natural phenomena. Well, the events after the flood were a natural result of, you know, whatever started the flood. Now, that's an interesting, you know, topic to take up one of these days. Mm-hmm. But after the, you know, the event, you know, started happening, and you had land masses kind of moving apart very rapidly, as we had discussed, you know, in a previous program, mm-hmm. for example, and volcanic activity spewing all kinds of stuff in the air, and then massive, you know, tidal waves that probably resulted because of all the geological activity that was going on. You know, you had a complete reshaping of anything on land. And so, obviously, you had a complete reshaping of everything under the water as well. So complete, in fact, that the ancient, the pre-flood floor of the ocean floor was completely subducted during this time. So the ocean floor was completely remade. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we would say as a young geologist, I mean, as a young creationist, for example, that the ocean floor that we examine today cannot be any older than probably, you know, 6,000 years or even younger than that, because the flood, you know, happened at almost 1,500, you know, 1.4, let's say, give or take, years after the start of everything here. So we're looking at, you know, back in 3,500 years ago.
And you're saying there are core samples, not only from the ocean bottom, but from land itself that indicate that, that there was a common event at about the same time. And they pinpoint that, maybe I shouldn't use that word, they guesstimate it to be at about, 4.6 thousand years ago.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can get Earth's history, for example, by looking at the chronology, again, that's in Genesis, mm-hmm. and looking at extra biblical, you know, history, for example, that which was written down, and say, well, you know, it looks like everything started about 6,000 years ago. And the flood was about this time, because we have a very good history in Genesis of this person begetting this other person and that person begetting so and so, and it tells the exact number of years that one person lived and exact number of years when somebody was born. Mm-hmm. So you can do the study yourself, up to Moses, for example, and find out, well, gee, how old are,
yeah.
you know, when did these events, early events, take place? And well, doing that, I think it's 1365 or something is the time mm-hmm. of the time of the flood, give or take. I haven't, you know, looked
that's
at the
1,365 years after the creation is what you're saying.
After the creation the flood, you know, took place. So
well, now the folks at Huffington on this article seem to be as frustrated with it as you are. They find fault with it, not the findings themselves, but basically say, well, what do we do with this stuff now? We don't know whether it indicates change one direction or the other, and so let's kind of throw it out. They're a little unhappy with the science themselves.
Well, they are, and it's kind of an incomplete type of study. And in the actual scientific article themselves, they reference some previous data and studies that were done. Mm-hmm. They referenced an older work, which was superseded by some newer work. And apparently that's in the same graph, or at least the footnote to the graph. And so it's actually quite confusing. And the other aspect of this, if you've got, Pacific Ocean warming, for example, it doesn't necessarily mean that the Atlantic Ocean is warming. Mm-hmm. And so unless you actually compare, the temperatures of both oceans, and you're trying to say something about global, warming in general, it's kind of a half-completed study.
It's also interesting if you take the old Earth approach, and if they're saying the Pacific Ocean warming is now at its fastest in the last 10,000 years, then it would maybe behoove you to ask, too, what about a million years ago or 2 million years ago? And is this any difference, or is it a natural cycle again? They have no basis for claiming that this makes any difference to us now, that anything here is man-made. And I'm not sure that they're trying to. I'm maybe assuming that, but it looks like there was not much reason for publishing this paper, actually.
Well, I mean, yeah. And they mentioned, well, okay, maybe over a couple of millennia we can see some changes. Mm-hmm. Well, saying that it's a couple of thousand years ago versus 10,000 years ago, as the article title, suggests, mm-hmm. is one thing. So I think the article's grossly overstated.
But people seize on this stuff and use it to then bend it to support whatever their argument is, whether it's global warming or global cooling or just climate change, if they don't know which way it's going.
And that's because it's, you know, science today is become sensationalized science. Mm-hmm. And you don't make a name for yourself unless whatever you're studying gets into your local newspaper. And so the way you do that is to capitalize on something spectacular, even though the work itself is probably not spectacular at all.
Now, at the risk of sounding overly cynical, what's the reward in this for a scientist or a group of scientists or a university? How do they benefit from getting published with a claim like this?
Well, the rewards are can be great. One, you know, you get more grant money as more people are aware of your work when you finally send in, you know, your another grant application, for example. And if your work has been published in secular media, as this one has, obviously, in the Huffington Post, you have a better chance of receiving grant money or continuing your work and saying, there's a great need to start, you know, to study this further. And it kind of justifies your work. So, unfortunately, that seems to be the name of the game these days, as opposed to real true, you know, science and trying to, you know, find out what, you know, what the truth is in the situation.
Of course, what we're reading here is Huffington's summary of an article that appeared in Science, the journal Science. What do you know of the journal Science?
Well, Science used to be a reputable, you know, journal article. I mean, a journal to publish in. And it is peer-reviewed. But, you know, these days, the peers are spectacularist, and I'll use that term kind of, you know, loosely here, themselves. And so what used to be, you know, true scientists reviewing other people's, you know, scientific work from a critical scientific point of view is now become popularized. And so if one of the reviewers, for example, happens to be on your same page, then you get your article published. If not, and you say something that is against the common thinking in that scientific clique, for example, then you don't get your published paper. You don't get your paper published.
So, in so many words,
of whether or not your scientific evidence is worth publishing or not. So, well, it's become very cliquish.
In so many words, it's been compromised.
It has been
by the economics,
okay. And it's not just science. It's you know, it's other journals as well. So
okay,
I guess I was interested in the final line of the article, that the author talks about the self-correcting machinery of science, but it doesn't seem like it's self-correcting. It doesn't seem like it's you know, it's exposing anything that's outside of the normal preconceived notion that the author has already decided, you know, what's going to be the final answer. You know, likewise, the peers that you're talking about, if they already believe in the conclusion that you're trying to come to, then yeah, they're going to approve of your particular ideas.
And right, and then if somebody comes and says, well, that's a bunch of baloney, that probably won't get published.
Right.
And so it's not self-correcting, you're right.
Well, of course, that self-correcting comment they attribute to Carl Sagan.
Exactly. Which, you know, he was a good promoter of billions upon billions of years, and you just look out in the in the heavens and you can figure out that it's billions and billions of years old. Well, you know, Carl Sagan's no longer with us, and he probably knows the truth now.
I imagine so.
I remember back in the, and this is a point that I was thinking about as you were talking about, you know, why would they do this? Why would they keep publishing these things? Why would they keep writing these articles? You know, what's the point? What do they get out of it? And I remember back in the ancient times when I wrote a master's thesis, and my advisor, both of my advisors said, the most important phrase that you must have in your article has nothing to do with your evidence, nothing to do with your research, but the phrase or the paragraph, further study is warranted.
Yeah, exactly.
no matter what you figure out, just make sure you include that.
That was, and that's part of your your training, you know, as a scientist.
And that's why David is in radio today, yeah.
Journal articles that I have written, probably could go back to them now. It's been some time, but I probably put in the that phrase too. I mean, it was kind of taught as you were a postdoc student or a graduate student that it's needed because, again, it was driven by grants from, you know, the federal government mainly. And so if you didn't say that further study was needed, then your funding kind of dried up. And in most things in science, you uncover just a very tiny, tiny bit of information from your scientific research, even though it takes you, you know, years to sometimes do some scientific research. You're just peeling the onion skin back, you know, just one layer at a time. And so to really get the full story, I mean, it can take decades. And then it's like, you know, one of these things, the more you learn, the more questions you wind up, you know, asking, which obviously leads to more research if you can live that long or other people pick up your work. And that's why.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm just, you know, I was just curious and I'm thinking about it. If someone cites you, in their own particular research, are you notified or does somebody ask you if they can cite you, or does that kind of, if you publish the paper, then anybody can cite you that they want?
Yeah, anybody can cite you. You don't necessarily get notified. I mean, you get notified. Usually what will happen is that someone who is doing research and is considering using your work, for example, and referencing you, will ask for a reprint of the article that they're, you know, going to be referencing, so that they have their own, you know, personal copy, if you will. So you'll know.
I've got that to look forward to then.
Absolutely. Yeah.
David, you know, I have to ask these.
You know, just get published, and I will ask you for a reprint, and therefore, you know, reference your article or book in my book.
Oh, okay. All right. David, this was just a master's thesis, and there's only two copies, so it's a,
these weren't the same people that recommended you become a history major instead, was it?
I think so. Oh, but it's the same guy. Yeah.
Okay, it all comes to light. The article is in the Huffington Post under their green news. There are a lot of links within the article to other studies and things, and you might find it interesting. We will have a link to this article with the podcast of our conversation with Dr. Don this morning. That'll be up on our website at brokenroadradio.com in just a couple of hours. And Don, Creation Moment, how's Creation Moments doing these days? Haven't talked to those folks in a while.
Well, we're doing well, and you know, we're up on 13 plus radio stations, 1,300 radio stations around the United States. A lot of syndicated stations, and in Russia as well, as we have a Spanish program. We have Spanish section to our website that keeps growing, and we are developing a one-minute program, which is taking our some of our two-minute, more popular two-minute programs and converting them to 1 minute to hope. The goal there is to attract some younger folks, younger generation into interest into, you know, creation science, or at least from the point of view that, hey, folks, when you go to universities, here's some evidence that, you know, perhaps what they're saying is not completely accurate, especially with regard to our origins and with regard to how old our universe and Earth is.
Yeah, and the basic message is keep an open mind and don't buy into assumptions that don't necessarily make sense. You gotta know the context of those decisions, those scientific observations and conclusions, and then maybe draw your own from a variety of sources. So always good advice for you on creationmoments.com is the website, and you'll find a lot of resources there for your church and your church library in particular. Also for your small groups and Bible studies, it's a great place to be familiar with. creationmoments.com. You can link to them from Broken Road Radio. And Don, thanks again so much for taking time out of your schedule. I know you're a busy wine grower, a grape grower rather. You don't just grow wine, do you? You have to make wine, right?
Well, it's called wine growing.
Oh, it is,
because okay. the wine making process starts in the vineyard. So
well, that makes sense. Okay, all right. So
hopefully, and we're learning. I mean, it's a learning process. We just got back from grape camp. And we weren't intense, but
my cartoon bubble has all kinds of pictures of grape camp now. Yeah.
Yeah, we were in a nice hotel, but and we learned some more information as to how to care for the vineyard. There was actually a lot of information about this past year was really rough for Texas growers in the High Plains in West Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the freeze frost, I mean, the frost that happened this past year, it affected us a very little bit, but it affected them greatly.
Yeah, Garden Valley is just east of Dallas. So the whole wine industry in Texas is kind of a fledgling industry, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say fledgling as it's struggling to get going. It is not a mature industry for sure. Uh-huh. Mature industry, you would think of France or Germany or Italy or something like that, or Spain.
Well, yeah.
North of California. California, if you say California is mature now, we're, far from being mature, but... a lot of the growers, and there's vineyards popping up all over the state of Texas.
Well, I've ever had a bottle of Texas wine, and I think the first one will come from your vineyard. I'm looking forward to that.
Is anybody talking about Appalachian yet?
Not that I'm aware of, okay. There's some. Actually, Texas is the major grower, the sole grower of a grape called the Blanc du Bois. Oh. And it actually, it's an American hybrid that came out of Florida from some work there. And they grew it for a number of years and then kind of gave up on it because it is a very vigorous vine. Texas picked it up. It's growing quite well here. It makes it's a varietal that makes all kinds of different types of whites, and you can make a rosé, obviously blending it with other things. You can make a sparkling wine, you can make a dry wine, you can make a sweet wine or a semi-sweet, and it's showing up pretty much all of those type of types of wines, and it's doing quite well here. One of the problems with having a new grape like this is that people aren't familiar with it. I mean, people are familiar with a Chardonnay. When they ask for a bottle of Chardonnay, they can generally know what they're going to get. And Blanc du Bois is so new that people don't have that knowledge yet. But here in Texas, we're going to try to make it known.
Well, look for Don's wine under the Chateau Cowpoke label. it'll be in a store near you in the not too distant future anyway. So
you mentioned Florida. We're at a winery, a wine sales shop in Key West years ago, and I think I remember them talking about the Blanc du Bois, that was one of their, and because I think I asked the question, is there an indigenous wine that Florida grows that nobody else does, and I think at that time it was the Blanc du Bois.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got our vines from Florida. Everybody did, but Texas really picked it up. And the reason why it grows so well and so nice here is because it's Pierce disease tolerant. Mm. So it can get Pierce disease and not die, which is a big plus.
Yeah, I guess so. Wow.
And so anyway, it can make a very nice wine. It not only do you have to care for it in the vineyard, but there's some things you need to do in the winery in order to make it a nice wine. And we're just trying to figuring out now how much acid and when to pick and, you know, sugar content and all this other stuff.
When the chemist goes to work, huh? And you don't have to put you can't put your feet up in the winter. You got still got work to do, don't you?
Oh, you do. And I've got about 124 gallons of white. Actually, most of it is Blanc de Bois. Aging. And I've got about 13 gallons of Shiraz.
Okay.
Going as well.
Yeah, it seems to me that the Blanc de Bois that I tried was a kind of a soft Sauvignon Blanc. A little bit fleshier than that.
It has. You can make it to be like a. I mean, you can make it fruity, like a Sauvignon Blanc or a Pinot Grigio. It can have its own characteristics, and it all depends how long you leave it on the vine, how much sun it's gotten, a lot of different things, and it'll come out. You know.
Okay.
So. Well, yeah, it's learning how to work with the grape.
Yeah, we'll learn a lot about a lot of things whenever we talk to Don here. And Don, we're grateful again for your time, and have a great week. Be blessed, and we'll talk to you next Monday, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
See you, Don. Thanks.
So long.